This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm talking to Martin Holliwell, who is a professor of history at the University of Leicester. He has authored and edited 14 books, including, most recently, the one we're talking about today, American Health Crisis, 100 Years of Panic, Planning, and Politics, which was just published by the University of California Press. Martin, welcome to the show.
Hi, Claire. Thanks so much for having me on.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Of course, yeah. You'll recognize from my voice that I'm British. Was educated in the Midlands in the UK. I spent some of my childhood in Seattle when my father was seconded with his work as an aeronautical engineer. So I guess my interest in American studies started from an early age, although I didn't do American studies until my PhD at Nottingham, University of Nottingham. My first degree was in English and my MA is in critical theory at the University of Exeter. And I wanted to mention a couple of people who really inspired me to continue to work in an interdisciplinary way, but also really set up, I suppose, my intellectual horizons. The first at Exeter was Michael Wood, who moved to Princeton. He's emeritus professor at Princeton. And he was always very sharp on thinking about the texture of language and the way that literary representations can often probe further than often sociological accounts can do. So although my work is largely now in cultural and intellectual history, I still use and try and weave that kind of work, that kind of literary work and attention to language into my historical projects. My master's dissertation became the basis of my fourth book, Images of Idiocy, which came out in 2004, which is a much more literary take on the medical humanities than this current book. But you'll see that there are elements of that attention to the texture of language and the idea that we can often probe further through cultural representations. Just a word about my move into intellectual history, University of Nottingham, my project, which became my first monograph, Romantic Science and the Experience of Self, which came out in 1999, was an attempt to construct a transatlantic counter tradition, which tried to counter normal science by bringing imaginative and creative subjects into dialogue with more empirical ones. I start with William James at the end of the 19th century and chart the course through a series of figures, some of them neo-Freudians like Otto Rank and Erik Erikson, and through to Oliver Sacks, who I interviewed as a graduate student in the mid-90s in Manhattan, and who I've, like William James, I've come back to as a touchstone through my later work. My mentor was one of my PhD supervisors, Richard King, who grew up in Tennessee and was educated at UNC and the University of Virginia. And Richard's really important because although he's best known for his work on the Southern Renaissance and on civil rights, his first book called Party of Eros that came out in 1970 was very much thinking about the role of neo-Freudian critics in culture and in social thought at large. They're stepping out of the clinic or the institution to think about how ideas take shape in the public sphere. Richard's a really important intellectual figure in American studies at large, particularly in the UK, and I often use him as a reader and as a sounding board. I guess the last thing that's worth saying in terms of biography is I've worked with and really valued working with historians of different shapes and sizes at the University of Leicester, particularly in the Center for American Studies. And I found the archive, not that I wasn't using archives as a graduate student, but I really found the archive increasingly important in my work, starting in 2004-05 when I was working on what became my fifth book on Reinhold Niebuhr, a theologian, social critic, whose archive at the Library of Congress is extensive. And I really am passionate about trying to bring archival work into dialogue with other forms of public discourse and public documents. And I don't think, had I not worked closely with different kinds of historians, I would have moved in that direction, despite the fact that I'm interested in the layering of discourses. I really think that my archival work has grown considerably over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, the evidence base for American health crisis is particularly rich. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book. Did you write the whole thing in quarantine?
No, I started writing it in 2015-16, so it took a longish time. How I came to write it, I'm working, and I can go back and talk to you a little more about this later, on a trilogy of books for Rutgers University Press. The first two volumes came out in 2013 as Therapeutic Revolutions and 2017 as Voices of Mental Health. The third book in that trilogy I'm working on now, and I wasn't really ready to do that over the last few years. But one of the reasons I wanted to look at a longer time period was that those volumes looking at 25 to 30 year slices of history. So Therapeutic Revolutions looks at discourses of therapy and the way that they oscillate between ideas around authority and liberation in the post-war years, so from Truman to Nixon, if you want to give it a federal cast, whereas Voices of Mental Health looks at the politicization of mental health in the 1970s and beyond, focusing on the Nixon to Clinton period. I really wasn't ready to write the most recent installment of that at the time. Plus, although I was using quarter or third century slices of history strategically in those books, I wanted to look at a broader expanse or horizon of history, but thinking about public health and the way that's often framed as a crisis more broadly. So mental health is an important aspect of the book, particularly the fifth chapter on care, but it goes well beyond that frame. I also had done some of the archive work for this book in those books on mental health, so I spent quite a lot of time, particularly in the Clinton and Carter presidential libraries in Little Rock and Atlanta. So I took the opportunity with this to go back and look at the pre-war period. I spent quite a lot of time on the Hoover and FDR libraries within the National Archives system, but also the Woodrow Wilson library, which is a private one. So I'd done a lot of the post-war archive work prior to this, and this book, because it starts in the 1910s with the Wilson administration, gave me the opportunity to think about the evolution of the public health service in those really important war and interwar years.
Well, the scope of the book is impressive. The evidence base is rich. You say at the beginning that you sort of didn't set out to replicate a history of medicine. Like I believe you used the example of John Burnham's Healthcare in America, sure. That this book is doing something else. Tell us a little bit about what you've tried to achieve with this 100-year history.
Sure. Well, I first started thinking about writing an institutional history of federal responses to health crises, starting in the 1910s and writing it in a chronological sequence, and using the Wilson and Trump administrations as the bookends. And in some ways, they are. The introduction focuses on 1918 and the conclusion on 2018, not just the opioid crisis, which is an important case study, the last one in the book, but I suppose the transition from Obama to Trump, where you have two very ideologically distinct notions of what health is, obviously in policy terms much sharper in the Obama administration, but that divergence or that polarity is really sharp in recent years. But I decided to move away from writing it chronologically. I think it's been done before. And also, when I was thinking about grouping health crises, they are more interesting, I think, to group by theme or by concept rather than moving through a chronological sequence, particularly as there are historical parallels and echoes and resonances, which are easier to tease out in that kind of thematic grouping. I was also interested in what a crisis is, so the reality of a crisis, particularly those that impact on communities, whether those are defined within a city or within a region or state, but also the rhetorical construction of crisis as well, and the way that it's used often quite anecdotally or casually or colloquially in discourse, but sometimes takes on more clarity and shape when it's linked or when it connects to that lived experience of an uncomfortable, sometimes life-threatening emergency that arises, sometimes at national level, as we've seen a number of times, sometimes internationally with COVID, and sometimes quite locally. So one of the case studies, for example, in the first chapter looks at the Buffalo Creek flood, which happened in the early 1970s in a poor mining region of West Virginia, didn't have the kind of national coverage or being brought into the national conversation in the way that Katrina or Harvey or Maria does, but it really is as important for thinking about how a health crisis happens, but also how it's constructed, both at the time and also sometimes retrospectively as well.
Let's talk a bit about that. So how do you define a health crisis? How is it constructed? And then what are the six crisis concepts that the thematic chapters that the book covers?
Sure. So it's called American Health Crisis. So you could ask why crisis singularly rather than multiply, in a multiple level. Well, I think the language of crisis is continuous through the 100 years that I look at, so the 20th century and early 21st, and across changing media as well, suggesting that it isn't just something that happens in exceptional phases, but part of the fabric of American life. Obviously goes beyond that as well. But I was mindful of what Naomi Klein said in 2017 when she describes ours is an age when it has become impossible to pry one crisis apart from all the others. They have all merged, reinforcing and deepening each other. Interestingly, Klein was talking at a Labour Party conference in the UK in 2017. And obviously, she's thinking from both an activist perspective, but also her work in environmentalism as well. But I think she's right, and not just for the present moment, that the entangling of discourses and realities and also senses of scale is something that I can see through the period that I'm looking at. The six modes or themes that the chapters focus on start with what I call disaster, although it's looking at floods, particularly floods in the south. And I've given one example of that with the Buffalo Creek flood. I look at poverty, and I look at the environment more broadly, both in terms of pollution, but also climate change and its effect on both human and animal health. In the second part of the book, I look at three other crises, those that are stimulated by the spread of viruses, particularly epidemics and pandemics. I think about care, so more institutionalized ideas of healthcare and the crisis, particularly dealing with mental health, but also other forms of health conditions that are tricky to get right in terms of providing care, which is both protective, but also allows the individual or the group to have some form of agency. And then the last chapter, I look at drugs, starting with, which actually starts in the introduction, where I look at the concern of the Wilson administration in trying to spread the illicit use and distribution of opiates in the 1910s. Through to the present moment with the opioid crisis, but also filtering that back through discussion of heroin and methadone in the 1970s and concerns about Valium addiction in the 1970s. So looking at the fulcrum between licit and illicit distribution and use of drugs. So those are the six crises concepts, and I was interested in crises that could also be seen on a newspaper headline or on the front page of a newspaper, because I'm particularly interested in the way that a crisis concept travels or is communicated. So the role of the media, both in terms of reporting but also framing stories, is really important for thinking both about how a crisis comes to be rhetorically, but also the channels by which it spreads.
And each of the crises, to me, it seemed, reading the book, each of the crises seemed cyclical. In other words, as a reader, I walked away from this book thinking, wow, public health in the United States has been perpetually in crisis in all of these different ways for the past century or so.
Sure, I would say that, although I didn't want to write a book that was heavily skewed to either a damning critique of government failure, nor simply a celebration of the resilience of communities. That's a really important part of the book, and we can come on to discuss that later, but to try and find a middle ground conceptually but also tonally to both offer a description of crises, some of which are well known, others less so, but also the interconnections between them. But I wouldn't disagree with you, Claire, on that.
I thought the book did that brilliantly in terms of finding a middle ground. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how your argument is in conversation with the work of Robert Bella. So Robert Bella, for our listeners, is a sociologist of religion. I read quite a bit of his work in graduate school because I took a handful of courses in the religion department in addition to my home department. But he's not someone that you often see so prominently featured in history of medicine books. And this book, American Health Crisis, quotes Charles Rosenberg at the end, but it's really built on some of the ideas of Robert Bella. And so I wondered if you could say just a little bit about him and how his work served as a source of inspiration for your argument.
Sure. I mean, interestingly, when I refer to Robert Bella, it's important to realize he worked collaboratively. So he was writing essays from the late 60s through to late in his career, but very early in this century. He wasn't a policy advisor, although was close to the Clinton administration. And although his background is Episcopalian and that informs his view of social justice, I think he's a really helpful figure for thinking both about the here and now, so about civic life and community, but also beyond the here and now as well, the importance of belief, whether that's in orthodox terms or just a notion of something that is beyond the empirical realm. I mentioned earlier with my PhD work, thinking about William James's notion of the radically empirical, so that which we can't explain without viewing it as something that's like, something that we can see or touch or feel. So those aspects, whether they're spiritual or imaginative, in our lives, we need to try and think about as being part of something that is like the more sensual realm or the empirical realm. I think Bella, like other figures I've looked at, Reinhold Niebuhr being one, allows us to navigate that between the more ephemeral or less easy to pin down aspects of our lives and those which are much more easy to document and to view. I'm not really interested in him as a religious thinker per se, although he does have this notion of civil religion, thinking about communities within civic life. And there's a reflection there, I think, of what it means to be part of a community of faith. The one thing that Bella does allow me to do, though, is he allows me to thread the needle between two types of discourses, ethical discourses, one which we'd call moralism, which is more about judgment. So when it comes into the realm of health, would be a language which is, I would say, is harming. So it'd be the idea of damage or stigma. Moralism is often there. We saw it during the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. Compared to that, you would have something which is much more progressive, a moral commitment to reform structures and services to improve prevention and treatment. I think it's easy without a thinker like Bella to think about the moral sphere as being entangled, but he does allow us to think about moralism on the one hand as being distinct from a moral commitment to improve or reform. That comes out of his notion of social justice. But he's also very interested in citizenship, the way of activating or stimulating involvement in community decisions, whether it's parts of, whether it's in terms of public debate or whether it's in terms of being part of governing structures to think about long-term planning, whether it's in terms of volunteering in a community health center. The language of agency is important for Bella, and it's very important, I think, when we think about health crisis, which, if we read it from a distance, seems to happen to a community. The community seems to be the passive victim of a force or set of forces beyond their control. And while health citizenship doesn't necessarily prevent a crisis happening in the future, I think it can make a community more resilient, more aware of itself, and also what exists beyond itself. So if we think about the World Health Organization's mantra that health is a right, not a privilege, you've heard it with Bernie Sanders and others recently, I think it's important not to forget that, but the danger is in the US, perhaps more so than the UK, that the economics of healthcare, particularly around insurance, dominates so much of the discussion that questions around what binds a community and what values we attach to health as a right sometimes gets occluded or forgotten. And I think Bella can bring us and remind us of those, I suppose, higher notions of what health is. It's about dignity, it's about respect, it's about self-care, but also care of others as well.
Can you say a bit more about pro-government and anti-government histories of public health or concepts of public health and how you managed to keep these sort of two points of view in perspective? Bella, I think, helps with that.
Sure. Well, Bella talks about what he calls the middle range, which he describes as between the local and the global. I think on first glance, that seems to suggest that it's the national or the federal level that, you know, is the answer to making sure that healthcare is balanced. And while I mean balanced, on the one hand, it's about a system, a healthcare system that is about organization and provision. And on the other hand, health is a public good. Sometimes the federal government can get it right. Would point to at least the first couple of years of the Lyndon Johnson administration in the mid-60s, which was geared to thinking about health as a public good. And Medicare and Medicaid, the major legislation that was passed during that time, is an example of that. But as I've mentioned already, in terms of being able to have foresight or to think about the structures and conditions that could be improved and may ameliorate a crisis or prevent it from happening, more often than not, those things aren't heeded, which is why we end up with this crisis cycle that the book portrays. But what Bella allows us to do is to think, I think, beyond polarities. And in the book, in the introduction and at various points during it, I refer to the notion of sympathetic state, the idea that the government is the provider, whether it's in terms of welfare or healthcare, is expected to provide for its citizens on large. And we see an example of this in FDR's New Deal commitments in the 1930s to particularly welfare, perhaps welfare more than healthcare, although he did have ambitions beyond what was achieved during the 1930s, as did Truman and Johnson and Clinton and Obama beyond that, in terms of thinking about government's commitment or what kind of commitment the government should have for protecting the health of its citizens. On the other hand, you have, and I use the thought of Paul Farmer in this respect, the notion that through systems of governmentality or surveillance, the federal government isn't that bothered about the health of its citizens. It's more about structures that keep individuals and communities in place. I suppose as a graduate student, that notion of critiquing power and institutions was very strong. In the 1990s, mid-1990s, when I was doing my PhD, the thought of Foucault particularly, but also Derrida and others, are about trying to critique and undermine the power structures of authority and institutions. And there's tons of histories, I think, that do that. And I think Bella allowed me to think about issues of power and structural violence, but without moving into a direction that's overly polemical. That's not to say that I just want to find a middle ground full of compromise, but institutions are important to Bella, and they're also important, actually essential, for thinking about healthcare delivery, what it means to have a community that's well served by healthcare facilities. we can't do without institutions. So I think moving too far into an anti-government perspective would be to, we may say it provides a clean sweep, but at the same time, it demolishes a lot of progressive legislation that's led to a system which at times is adequate, other times shows cracks and lacks the kind of stability one would hope to have. So that middle ground is really important. It does help me thread the needle between those two polar views of both the role of government when it comes to national healthcare, but also the ideology behind those two positions.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, the book is divided into two parts. One is called Geographies of Vulnerability and the other is called States of Vulnerability. And you really do a wonderful job of talking about how institutions can both create vulnerabilities, but can also sort of provide a buffer or supports against them, as you know, to help people who might be in vulnerable positions. Can you tell us a little bit about what are these two types of vulnerability, the geographies of vulnerability and the states of vulnerability, and how are they created?
Sure. Well, I was very interested in place, and I talked earlier in the discussion about the importance of the archive. But I also tried to do some field trips as well to give the case studies real definite contours. For example, I spent some time on Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, which informs the third case study in the second chapter on poverty that looks at issues around American Indian health in the late 1990s. And I also did some work in Alaska as well, thinking about the impact of the Exxon Valdez spillage in the 1980s on both human but also animal communities as well there. So I did try and think about the importance of place in this book, perhaps more so than anything I've written before. And that informs the first half of the book, which is deeply rooted in geography and locality. And it's in out of the way, one might say, although that would be demeaning, out of the way places for at least Congress, that crises often arise. There is this discourse called the third worlding discourse, which we could apply to a hurricane like Hurricane Maria, where in Puerto Rico, the Trump administration really were forced or even goaded into acting responsibly in the face of a major crisis. And I think that is sometimes plays out in more banal or benign ways in Congress, you know, that a crisis is over there and not in your face, and therefore government doesn't have to respond as quickly or as proactively as it might. It's interesting too that that Calvin Coolidge in the 1920s, I look at the Mississippi flood in the late 1920s, and Coolidge deliberately didn't want to offer immediate assistance to communities in the South because it would set a precedent that he and other presidents would have to live by. You know, the first sign of a crisis or health emergency, the federal government would be expected to step in. So instead, he sent Herbert Hoover, who worked with the Red Cross, to offer aid and come up with a plan for alleviating a major health crisis in the South. So the first part looks very closely at geography and locality. The second part of the book tries to zoom out and think more about structures at national level, but also at state level as well, in terms of thinking about structures that both frame crises, and sometimes when they are shaky or often don't live up to the ideals that one might expect of health institutions, are the reasons why vulnerabilities arise. So I'm particularly interested throughout on communities that are underserved in terms of health services, whether those are communities of color or in rural places or poor urban areas, or those living near toxic waste. And I've got a couple of case studies on that in the book. I think what crises do is they often reveal structures of inequality and exclusion that are sometimes hiding in plain sight. They're there all around us, but the health crisis, as we've seen with COVID, in terms of prevalence, in terms of hospitalizations and comorbidities, often hide in plain sight, but often are brought to the forefront in the face of a crisis. The theme of vulnerability as well, I think, I've talked about this a little earlier in the conversation, allows me to think about something that's both material and existential. That's to say, vulnerabilities in systems and in places, but also vulnerability as what I call a psychosociological predisposition towards stress and debility. That's to say that it's a psychological state or an existential state as much as a material one. However, the last point on this, I tried to not use the language of fragility, because I think that undermines the idea that communities and individuals can be resilient and resourceful in the face of hardships. So vulnerability, I think, doesn't have the same kind of negative valence as a term like fragility, which is often used to talk about the environment. But I think there's a danger of using it in terms of describing or encircling a community. It robs agency rather than recognizes there's a problem, but also reserves the right for a community to come to a sense of its own sense of crisis rather than having it imposed upon them.
I think the book does a really good job of that in terms of it, although it is, you cover a series of crises, it does not read like a march of tragedy, just sort of one horrible, tragic thing after another. There's a lot of richness and complexity in the case studies that you choose. We don't have time to talk about all six of the crisis concepts, but I thought maybe we could give listeners kind of a sample and talk about one from the first half of the book and one from the second half of the book. And so for the first one, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about natural disasters and how natural disasters become public health crises.
Of course. So I've referred to the first chapter, which I call Disaster, but looks at the southern floods, looks at three southern floods earlier in the conversation. The floods are the Great Mississippi Flood of the late 1920s, the Buffalo Creek Flood in West Virginia and towards the Kentucky border in 1972, and Hurricane Katrina in 2005. I do take the liberty in the coda of this chapter to think about the resonances of Katrina, but also thinking about the idea of the Southern flood through Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Maria as well. And I've again given you some sense there of issues around the government being slow, the federal government being slow to respond to what start off as local or regional crises before they become seen as national ones. Of course, natural disasters are rarely just natural. That's to say that there's usually a human hand or a human institution that has laid the ground for that particular occurrence to happen. You could see it in from the late 19th century, I think, in the way that the Mississippi was divided up into, Mississippi River was divided up into private interests, rather than thinking about it as an ecology, something that where one element affects the other. And obviously you can see it resonate through to Hurricane Katrina and the devastation of that in terms of the lack of seawall defences around the Mississippi Gulf Coast. So I'm interested in the way that a natural disaster is shaped by human hands, which is one of the strong themes in the first part of the first chapter of the book. I should also say that often the language of crisis is a broad one. That's to say that the Secretary of Health and Human Services, if we're thinking domestically, or the World Health Organization, if we're thinking globally, would call a public health emergency, which allows them to operationalize and coordinate activities and direct resources. So emergency tends to be a more operational term than crisis, which I've talked already has a more existential valence, which takes us into the realm of experience, but also into the realm of drama as well. And it's the way in which I think crisis is both constructed and inflamed in the media that interests me. In terms of these three floods, I suppose they offer case studies in terms of scale. Mississippi flood affected states from Illinois down to Louisiana. The Buffalo Creek flood, a micro community, if you like. Hurricane Katrina, both the city, New Orleans, but along the Gulf Coast. So they had effects on different scales of community. And scale is an important theme in the book. I talk in the introduction about derangements of scale, which is a term that Timothy Clark developed, and the way in which sometimes with a crisis it's often hard to determine what the right scale is. Mm-hmm. You know, often emotions are heightened or lives are on the line, or the spectacle of the flood can take us into a realm where it's hard to actually perceive what's going on. Hurricane Katrina was a clear sense of this, particularly as it was hard for some media outlets to get into the city, and also because there was so much rumor and speculation in terms of what was going on. So I think I start there. I start with chapter one with natural disasters, although I'd reframe that and say that disasters that have a human hand behind them, but also brings us into view with these issues around scale and how important it is to try and think carefully about what scale is appropriate when we're both framing a crisis but also dealing with one.
For the second half of the book, I wondered if we could talk a little bit about the chapter that is titled Virus, because that one seems, particularly relevant to the world we're living in today. And you cover three different viruses, influenza, polio, and HIV and AIDS. Tell us a little bit about what you conclude about how viruses relate to states of vulnerability.
Sure. One thing I did want to mention is, and I did early on, the role of writing and cultural expression. And I think that's an important part, both of the flood chapter, but also the virus chapter as well. And there are three viruses that obviously are well known and documented widely in terms of both the historical record and different types of interpretation of them. So there was a rich body of literature to draw on with influenza, polio, and HIV, AIDS. And sometimes that's on a reflective level as well. So with this chapter, which is one of the first I wrote for the book, I mentioned the flood chapter is the first of the book, but I think the virus chapter was the first one I wrote. It allowed me to zoom in on particular phases of those viruses. Obviously, the great influenza epidemic was 1918-19, although there were various arguments about when it started and also when it ended. There was a widespread contraction of post-encephalitis in the 1920s, and there's still speculation about whether that's the tail end of the influenza epidemic or whether it was a discrete phenomenon. With polio, which starts or arises in the 19th century, I kind of look at the way in which polio was episodic from the 1910s through to the development of the polio vaccine in the early 1950s. But I'm particularly interested in that moment in the 50s as well, which I think resonates with today because there were a number of vaccine trials, but also the rollout of the vaccine where the government made some missteps, and in fact, missteps that could have been taken perhaps a bit more seriously in the last 12 to 15 months when thinking about what kind of structures and institutions need to be involved, particularly in vaccine rollouts. With HIV/AIDS, I focus in probably the most obvious period during the Reagan and George W. Bush years when HIV/AIDS had so much stigma attached to it and so little understanding by the federal government. So I look at particular slices of the crisis phase or experience as a whole, but I also try and give a sense of the long durée of those crises as well. And of course, with HIV/AIDS, we could say the crisis continues, particularly in some African countries. The other thing to say, I think, particularly because the book starts in the 1910s, that the influenza epidemic, although it wasn't the only crisis that the Woodrow Wilson administration was trying to face, I mentioned the illicit spread of opiates in the 1910s, inner city poverty would be another, venereal disease and its spread in the armed forces. There were a number of crises that the Wilson administration was forced to tackle with uneven results. But I think that the fact that there were a number of exhibitions and remembrances of the great influenza epidemic in 2018, the CDC had an exhibition which had some amazing photographs that I hadn't seen before of both mask wearing, but also treatment of influenza patients. And I often, the Vietnam War is often seen as being the first media war. Well, I didn't really think about the great influenza epidemic as probably being the first media epidemic in terms of that range of photographs. The cover of the book has a photograph that circulated in the media in the spring of last year. It was a recently found photograph by an Oakland amateur photographer, Raymond Coyne. And it depicts a group of Marin County Californians wearing masks in November 1918. It's never been published until recently, that is. But it does resonate, obviously, with the politics of mask wearing, which has become increasingly tense, or perhaps less so right now, although that's arguable, but certainly over the last 8 to 9 months. So there are resonances there. When I first drafted the chapter, I didn't think about mask wearing in a politicized way, but clearly it became so in the light of the uneven federal messaging around mask wearing in response to COVID.
And if you look at the cover, it doesn't obviously look like a historical photograph. You have to stop and take a closer look and to try to pinpoint the periodization too, I would say.
Sure. If I could just add one other thing, I did want to mention this because the book is about government response at an institutional level, but I am interested in leadership. And I think the COVID crisis gave me a sense of someone like Anthony Fauci, who, when I first drafted the HIV/AIDS section, wasn't featured in that at all. But looking back at his role, both in terms of engaging with HIV/AIDS activists in the late 80s, early 90s, but also his friendship with Reagan's Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, who did change the tone of the federal response to AIDS by switching away from questions around moralism and family values to thinking about HIV as a public threat. So Fauci's role during that time, I wouldn't say it was forgotten or occluded, but I think his more prominent role during the current crisis allowed me to reflect back on a kind of ethically committed but also scientifically hyper-aware role that he had in that really pivotal moment for shifting the dial on the public rhetoric around HIV/AIDS.
Well, Martin, we are almost out of time, but I want to ask one more question before we get to our sort of traditional final question. And that is, the book has something called Coda 2020. So it has a conclusion, and then it has another little section at the end that sort of brings us all the way up to the present and possibly even the future. And in the Coda, the book offers the possibility that we might build, and this is quote, an active public health culture that can be both responsive and reflective. Can you say more about that? What would a culture like that look like, and how would we go about building it?
Sure. Well, so I've talked about health citizenship through my reading of Robert Beller. I've talked about involvement in civic affairs, whether it's public debates or governance or volunteering. But I think there are other things as well. So if we think about culturally congruent health, whether it's thinking about the language in which public health education and information is promulgated, or we think about the importance of traditional healing practices or alternative health in dialogue with the modern bureaucratic health system in the US. So health citizenship would be engagement, but it also would be pushing at the boundaries of what currently exists to try and find a way of either improving or looking beyond that. Another way of framing this would be to think about public health as a culture rather than a system, and that culture would be a shared resource for a community rather than, as I mentioned earlier, systems, which I think in a country so vast as the US are always going to be under strain, always vulnerable to shifts in government policy or to the purse strings in Congress. The third thing, I think, is the notion of what Beller calls a politics of imagination. And I think this is where cultural reflection whether it's in literature or film or journalism or music, comes into the book that helps us to work through the experience of a health crisis, sometimes during the crisis itself and other times in the rearview mirror. So that's the reflection, I think. I think it's not just about citizenship in a rights-based way. That's crucially important. But I think there's a reflective side to it that can be activated as well.
I love this idea of a public health culture, and one that we participate in and we can help shape. I have taken up too much of your time. So I'm going to bring us now to our traditional final question, which is, okay, so this is book 14. What is book 15? What are you working on next?
So I have two things. One, which is a big edited volume called Politics of American Health, which has around 40, largely US actually, contributors, which looks at topics of community and children's health through to questions of rights and environmental justice. That'll be out next year with Edinburgh University Press. And then the third of the trilogy I'm working on for Rutgers, which goes back to 1990 to think about the development of biotechnology during what was called the decade of the brain, but also the biotech acceleration that's happened since the 1990s. The idea is to complete that trilogy looking at mental health and the way in which biotech has both reframed ideas around mental health and illness, largely by thinking about the relationship between, I suppose, the material and the immaterial, again, the relationship between brain and consciousness would be one example. But also, it's given me chance. I think history's caught up with me. If I'd written this project up a few years ago, I think it would be about a biotech future that's about not infinite expansion, but about one that's increasingly reliant on technology. Whereas I think both the COVID experience, but also the colliding crises that President Biden has spoken about, shows that technology isn't always the answer to issues, particularly when it comes to human behavior. And I think as I'm working through this, again, I'll try and thread the needle, I think, between technology seen as either as a curse or a blessing. And I think what's happened, although it's horribly tragic and no one would ever have wanted it, does provide us with, a new horizon for thinking about the role of technology within the sphere of health.
That's a good point. So your history is sort of the way that the history would be written has changed just in the past couple of years based on our current circumstances.
I think that's right, although I think there's always a danger with contemporary history of getting it wrong. If I can just be self-reflective on American health crises, I think there's a couple of things. You know, I wrote the code in October. If I could write it now, it would strike a slightly different tone, particularly issues around leadership, but also what's happened in terms of racial justice. I think that would be a stronger theme if I was to write it now. So I think there's always a danger, you know, of thinking you're putting a final word on something and then 5 minutes later, the horizon shifts again. So it will take me a little while to finish this project. And it is exciting dealing with the contemporary moment, but also quite daunting as well.
Well, they both sound like wonderful projects, both the edited collection and the third in the trilogy. Martin, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your work with our audience today.
Thanks so much, Claire. I really appreciated the opportunity to talk with you.